The following contains strong language, violence, and nudity. It is intended only for mature audiences. Discretion advised.
Go on, I'm listening.
I just wanted to find those code numbers.
I'm not interested in code numbers, Terry. We lost a rather large number of weapons from that ordnance annex a week ago. I don't want to have to explain this screw-up to the president.
It may have been an inside job, sir.
What are you talking about?
Well, sir, I've been running some cataloging reports on my own. And I caught some code discrepancies in our weapon storage files.
Go on.
I did some checking, and crazy as it sounds, it looks like someone might be diverting weapons shipments to other delivery sites, then changing the info in the computer.
You have any proof of this?
It's all here in my report.
Who else have you talked to about this?
No one, sir. I wanted to come straight to you.
Excellent. I'm glad you did. As of right now, Terry, your job is to track down every instance of these discrepancies in the weapons shipment files. I'll need verification and documented evidence if I'm going to get into this with a full-scale investigation.
Yes, sir.
Keep me informed.
I just want to go on record and say, I hope I'm wrong. I hope this is just some horrible mix-up.
I'll second that. Thank you, Terry. Goddamn boy scout. Last thing I need is him turning a few heads by talking to someone. Fortunately, Terry's a loyal puppet. Always works in the best interests of his employer. Let him find all the loose ends. We'll tie them up later.
Welcome to Spawnometer. I'm your host, Mr. Fixit. With me today is...
Diablo Frank.
So, Frank, what are we going to play with here today?
Well, I'll start off with the extended intro to Spawn number 12, Flashback Part 1, this time solely by Todd McFarlane, aside from the editor and letterer Tom Wojciechowski, and colors by Steve Olif and Ruben Rude of Oleoptics. This one is dedicated to Shel Dorf, who was the founder of the San Diego Comic-Con. He died a few years after this dedication.
R.I.P.
Spawn. More appropriately, Hellspawn. The officers in training of the Malbolgia, sent to the living world to hone their potent yet limited supply of power. They must first prove worthy of their rare selection as a warrior from the realms beyond. The latest recruit, and the first this century, is Lieutenant Colonel Al Simmons. Millions of souls, both good and evil, were bypassed before Simmons was appointed. He had the gift, the right wiring, the well-tooled machinery. During his first existence on Earth, he had shown a willingness to follow orders to kill, to murder, to slaughter, all in the name of duty. He didn't believe in the great beyond, but his atheistic leanings only made Hell's selection of him even more satisfying. Yet the unbeliever cannot be chosen against his will. He or she must open the door to evil willingly and without hesitation. The surreal trauma of death experienced by each soul leaves many open to exploitation. The evil one quickly found the chink in Simmons's emotional armor. Love. Not for duty or country, but for someone. This weakness has been the greatest of all aids to enlistment for Malbolge's army. Easily manipulated, newly arrived souls will barter nearly anything for love. They will promise, and evil will accept. Thus, their fate is sealed. The pact will be in effect for eternity. This irony, love is evil's trump card, is not hidden from God. Someday, these two powers will clash over this cosmic holy grail. Armageddon will be fought for the reasons humans exist in the first place. Love. Al Simmons traded his soul for it. Eventually, the new Spawn will have all his answers. Until that day, he can only continue to struggle for some sense of order and meaning to his existence. His memory has already accessed some vital clues, but others are buried deep in his subconscious and emerge only sporadically. Of these brief visions, how many are to be believed? How many have been changed? At least he accepts the notion that his life is completely out of control. The fight with Angela, the angel warrior, sent him to purgatory, temporarily disconnecting his powers. When all seemed lost, he blinked, only to find himself back on Earth again, among his newfound friends, New York's homeless. His powers obviously include transmutation and reality adjusting. Unfortunately, neither is at his discretion, nor is the lure of this church. Now, for the third time, he has heeded its call, not knowing whether some divine spirit is trying to help or haunt him. His still human thought process allows him to make only the obvious personal connection, his wedding.
Cyan, child, stay out of those chocolates and get an apple like Granny told you to.
All right, Granny.
Then we get a flashback to him getting married. We see him hanging out with Grandmother Blake, who is much leaner. She really swole up in those 5 years.
Are we fat-shaming Grandma Blake?
The diabetes must have really got into her in that five-year time span. Oh, she must have taken the death of Al Simmons really hard. She's talking about how she was trying to talk Wanda into taking her husband's name, yes. But she refused. The same thing she did with Terry Fitzgerald. More power to her.
She's really strong. I'm sure she's on your soapbox.
What else happens here? You should be taking over from here.
It's just kind of a recap of what was going on with the story in terms of how Al is still trying to reconnect with his old life. He's apprehensive to see that if they still miss him or not. He's not sure.
That's all right, child. I'll get it. Who could that be? Yes? Can I help you?
I'm looking for Wanda Blake.
And who is this that's asking?
Just an old friend of hers, back in town.
Well, now, I know most of Wanda's friends.
Hi, it's me, Cyan.
I'm sorry to have bothered you.
Would you like to come in and wait for her?
No, I've made a mistake.
He confronts Grandma Blake to see if, you know, Wanda still thinks about him. And she talks about how she visits every Wednesday and talks about
him. Her love's just as strong as ever. Does she recognize him as Al?
As soon as he starts talking, I think so.
Please, don't go. At least not yet, Al.
Granny?
What? You think I still wouldn't know you? I visit your grave every Sunday to talk to you. And pray for you. I prayed that you'd answer me in some way.
I could use a few prayers.
So she thinks it's like his spirit or something talking to her, right?
Yeah, because he's like, you know, I'm from the great beyond.
Is he in his white boy mode?
I'll usher you into the heavens. And she's like, oh, I can't wait to hang out with you there. And he's like, well, I ain't there, sweetheart. Like,
right. Is he in his white boy mode?
No, he's in his deformed pizza mode.
Okay. So he's just full on Spawn?
Yeah, he's all spawned out, except he's wearing a member's only coat with a baseball cap. So.
And that was a sequence that they largely adapted for the cartoon in the later seasons.
No, they never used that in a movie.
I don't think Grandma was in the movie. Granny,
Yeah, I can't remember the movie. It's been a while.
And we've seen Grandma Blake before, right? This isn't her introduction, is it?
No, I can tell you that this whole issue to me was a recap of...
But I'm asking you, though, was Grandma Blake in any of the early issues, or did we just now introduce her?
Yeah, the first one.
She was in the first issue?
I want to say she was.
Granny Blake was in the first issue, really?
Not the first issue, but like in the first run of Spawn, because I want to say whenever he sees her...
We'll have to go look. This might be her first appearance.
She wasn't prominent, but she did pop up. She's
going to be in a lot of these Spawn comics.
Because she seems to be... She's going to almost become the in-between between Al and Wanda's new life, because he starts asking, does Wanda miss me? Wanda's new kid, Wanda's new husband. Basically, she's the gossip in the neighborhood. She's telling him all the stuff that he wasn't able to learn. She's filling in all the gaps in his mind of what's going on.
Well, and to some degree, she was like the Cagliostro of the comics. She didn't have the supernatural connections that he had, but she was sort of like Spawn's guide and sort of his sounding board and the person he would go to talk things out with and have advice from and stuff.
I guess.
She was like one of the only people who knew who he was and he could actually relate to.
We'll have to read a little bit more to see if she fulfills your role. So at this point, CNN E is used.
Yeah,
the entertainment channel, and they have a guy from
the Rush Limbaugh
6. No, he's supposed to. I'm assuming supposed to be like, I guess, a local, because you have CNN E and then Viacom.
Well, see what it is. You've got Connie Chung on the network. You've got a stereotypical gay reporter for E, and then you've got the bloated conservative who's a Morton Downey Jr. or a Rush Limbaugh, and he moves from channel to channel because he keeps getting fired for his far right rhetoric.
True, could be, but they all kind of.
And well, you remember too, Rush, when he had a TV show. He was on syndication. He was never on a network.
We'll get you off your soapbox.
Okay.
It's just a comic.
I'm just saying.
So Al is very curious about what's going on with Wanda, and if he still feels like he's trying to see, he's feeling out if he still has a shot.
Yeah.
He's feeling it out. And then, of course, we see Sam and Twitch, and they're, I believe, still under investigation because they found Billy's body in their office.
Right. There's still some questions about whether or not they did some...
jammed in all kinds of orifices.
Right. Whether they did some little vigilante action or something.
I believe they're stuck at desk duty for the time being. And then we see Wanda walking with her daughter, Cyan.
They're definitely touching base with all the characters that have been established on the series to get people back into the regular flow of the comic after this extended break with all the writers series.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm telling you. When I was reading this, it felt like, oh, he's just trying to remind me of everything I just fucking read a few weeks ago. Okay. Yeah.
Although I appreciate that. One of the things that's nice about Spawn is it grounds you. You know what the fuck's going on. One problem that Image has is sometimes they throw so much stuff at you that you're kind of like, wait, who's this person and why was this happening and stuff? And Spawn someone, somebody to its detriment, always reminds you, okay, this is where we're at, this is what we've been doing, and we can go from here now.
Well, we're introduced to the child, Wanda, and her daddy, which is Terry, and I guess at this time, Spawn realizes, right, that Terry, his best friend, is married to Wanda. He now realizes that Wanda didn't even take his last name, that she's keeping, I guess, her last name, which I believe even Grandma Blake brought up as, won't that be a problem for the child? Because how many names will the child have? And so Terry, at this point, I believe it's Jason Wynn, is concerned about a spy within his organization. It's kind of hinted that Terry has a lot of access to areas that would...
He performs a lot of audits and stuff, so he has access to some sensitive information.
Yeah, that would make shine a light on Jason Wynn's illegal activity.
Well, he finds some irregularities that he brings to Wynn's attention, right?
Yeah. They send some tough guys to go talk to Terry. First thing they say is, it'd be a damn shame if something happened to your family. So you kind of know where they're going with this.
Were they hired by Michael Cohen?
Dude, you and your damn... The suits go back to Jason. They tell him, hey, we delivered the threat. I think he got the message. He's laughing about it. We're reintroduced to Spawn hanging out in did they ever give a name to the alley that he hangs out?
I just call it Spawn Alley because that's what they call it in didn't they actually do
the cartoon,
a toy set?
They call it Rat Alley.
Yeah, Rat City, I think, in the cartoon. Yeah.
He's down there. He's drinking out with the homies. They're singing the Flintstones.
Yabba yabba dabba do time. Yabba do time. We'll have a gay old time.
And so they're all having drinks. They're all having a good time.
Oh, this is a big deal because they were singing the Flintstones theme. They're really, Todd seems like he's really rubbing it in Hanna-Barbera's faces without appreciating how badly that was going to end up turning out.
Oh, yeah. And I we'll bring that up in just a moment. And so they're all having a drink and they're talking about Jurassic farts and all kinds of just.
Yeah.
A lot of locker talk. One of the guys that hangs out with him, one of the homeless guys, picks up Spawn's mask and puts it on, pretending to be Spawn, and the mask automatically attacks him, goes into attack mode.
Tries to suffocate him, right?
Basically, yeah. They're able to get the mask off. Spawn apologizes. And everyone's cool, but he's trying to warn everybody, like, I don't have full control of this costume. If it senses the threat, it's going to attack, and I don't have 100% control over it. That's a weird area to put him where he has this very powerful weapon on him at all time that's part of him, but yet he doesn't have full control of this weapon.
Well, I mean, the symbiote is Hellspawned. It's a distinct entity from Spawn himself. Now, I believe that they've already said in the comics, I think Cagliostro told Spawn that the suit loved him.
Yeah,
but it's still an infernal device. I can see where that might be a problem. But once again, you've talked a lot of shit about how Spawn is basically a ripoff of Spider-Man and Doctor Strange. But yeah, the fact that there's a symbiote, it's very venomy.
Yeah,
that's maybe like Todd McFarlane taking it back. He was the co-creator of Venom, but he doesn't get any money off that or any credit off of it. Or he gets some credit, but no money. So maybe he was sort of like, well, I'm going to take the symbiote, even though he obviously didn't invent the symbiote aspect. So
yeah, that
I guess
was Mike Zeck's creation.
The costume was based on an idea by a fan. Mike Zeck was the first person to realize it as a drawing, but the actual concept probably came out of the Spider-Man editorial office or from Jim Shooter. Point being is, I don't think that Todd McFarlane had ever heard the word symbiote before somebody wrote into a script for a Spider-Man that he was drawing.
And let's be honest, Venom really didn't become Venom until later on, I think.
I think that he had a decent version of Venom in the McFarlane.
I'm going to eat your brains.
I liked Eric Larson's version of Venom better. I think it had more character with the fang. He had the full fangs and he had the tongue.
The jaw too, didn't his jaw?
Yeah. Which is funny too, because then McFarlane would do Violator with the slack jaw.
Al has a moment of clarity where he starts having flashbacks of his past life and he sees a skull.
Initially, he's thinking it's just about the skull relating to his death. Just like the American flag relates to his casket. The cross was just the place where he got married, the church where he got married, his lack of faith perhaps damning him. He's been misinterpreting these images that he's been seeing the whole time, but he finally puts it together arbitrarily.
And it's Chapa! Which, at this point, I don't think we really knew who he was, did we?
Within the Spawn comics, he had not appeared, no. He was already in Youngblood, but if you were only reading Spawn comics...
You didn't know who he was.
Who the fuck is Chapel?
Yeah, so it was kind of like, okay. Like,
it's like, what a ripoff. You know, you did not set this up at all. They've made allusions to the Youngblood program, but no connections directly to any members of the team within the Spawn comics. So if this were a murder mystery, Todd McFarlane completely cheated by not giving you any clues that would allow you to form it based solely on Spawn.
Well, it had no emotional impact. It would have been different. I think, it's Chapel, my favorite character at the beginning who saved Wanda's life and saved that box of kittens.
Right. No, it was his best Chapel. Friend.
Yeah. It's just Chapel.
Okay. Oh, that's the guy from Youngblood. It definitely sells the Image Comics universe.
Yeah.
But if you're just reading Spawn. If you're like, I love Todd McFarlane, I love Spawn, this is the only book I'm going to read, completely out of nowhere. Okay, so what did you think of this issue?
It was a waste. It was just basically a, hey guys, remember this from the first book you read before, like, I had a bunch of writers come in and flush out my universe? Remember, this is the story I wanted to tell y'all? Here it is again.
Although I will say, especially when you see that little part that I was quoting at the beginning, you can see where he's embedded that material into his own lore.
Yeah.
The actual events of the writer series doesn't get in much to much of a degree touched on in this issue, but you can see where he really is explaining, I'm in Hell's Army, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. And you can see particularly where the Neil Gaiman influence comes in.
But again, it was just a rehashing of basically everything we've read up to that point.
Yeah.
Minus the writer's block.
Well, I think that he was thinking that he picked up some readers from the writer series, which is a reasonable, very possible, because I mean, the first issue sold really well, and then the subsequent issues were in the $500,000 range.
So this is just a,
and then
this,
the writer series
a jumping on point.
Yeah, because my understanding is Spawn had gone from the 2 million high of the first issue down to somewhere in the realm of 500,000 to 600,000 per issue, especially number four. Number four was a hot book for a while there because it was low printed basis on demand, mm-hmm. and there weren't enough copies to go around, and it actually managed to be one of the top 10 hot Wizard books for a while there. When the book jumped back up to 1 million copies for the Alan Moore issue, and I think a little over 1 million copies, or one of, they both did, I think most of the writer series did about 1 million copies. So it's reasonable to assume that some of those people that came in for those writers stayed on.
Yeah.
So it totally makes sense that he would want to make sure to get those readers up to date on what he's doing, and also show that the story's advancing by revealing who Spawn's killer was. It's just too bad that they totally cheated on not building up to that.
True. It should have a crossover or something to give us, instead of doing a crossover after we find out who it is. I guess when you put it in that light, yes, it was a very good jumping on point. If this was your first podcast to listen with us, you could be like, well, fuck the rest of that shit. I'm on board. Issue one here. I can start here. So
the audio on some of those are fucked. We're just going to skip those and jump right into episode 12.
They were a lot more fun after issue 12. I think they really got their footing. They knew what they were doing.
There you go. After reading issue number 11, this was a huge improvement.
Well, dude, a lot of fucking words. Todd, he just threw up. Blah, language. Blah.
He was basically the anti-life. Liefeld did not have enough words on his pages. McFarlane was making up for it by having way too many words.
He's just like, I mean, think he just started making up shit after a while.
Well, toward the beginning there, it very much felt like he was looking at how many words per page Neil Gaiman was packing on, and was trying to match that, thinking that would equal the
contest.
But also, he did get Tom Orzechowski too. Orzechowski was famous for doing X-Men, and another writer that's well known for overwriting was Chris Claremont. So he got the right letterer for the job, at least.
Well, I mean, they definitely squeezed lettering everywhere they could.
Well, I think McFarlane also realized that he could do it in a small one-page pinup and just have a whole column of words and not have to put in a lot of effort to the drawing. Clever little trick reading, get the book out on a monthly basis. And pretty much every character is reintroduced in here, with the exception of Clown and Malbolgia.
I just wish he had done it on issue 11 so you could have said it's number 1-1.
Yeah.
Having a good time, I trust.
Yeah, whatever.
You really should learn how to relax, Chapel.
Blood helps me relax. Got any for me?
A weapons shipment going to North Korea. You accompany with our compliments.
And?
Wait 9 hours, then obliterate the shipment and give them a bloody nose. After that, I'll have something for you closer to home.
When's the hop?
Tomorrow morning. Usual pickup and delivery.
I don't like a lot of downtime, you know that.
So get a hobby.
You're coming with me.
Chapel, we're partners, right?
Sorry! Sorry! Sorry!
Who initially had the idea for Image? Was it Rob? Was it Todd? Who did you first hear about it from?
I first heard about it from Todd, but I believe it was Rob and Todd and I think Jim Valentino early on. And I know that Eric Larson was part of the early conversations.
And ironically, I heard about it in New York because I was visiting Marvel Comics for an X-Men summit, a creative summit. And I think Rob Liefeld at the time already, knew that, okay, we're going to do something. I don't know if it was called Image Comics at that time or whatever, but him and Todd had already, cooked this thing up, and it was going to happen. Where, however many guys, there was no number at that time, however many guys were going to break away and start their own thing. So Rob was actually at that same meeting.
Yeah, because he was part of the X family at the time.
Yeah, he was part of the X family with X-Force. So it was like this big X-Men meeting with all the major players, creative and editorial. So I had this idea that I was going to pitch at the meeting. I think Bob Harris was kind of the guy. And he was conducting the meeting, and he said, anybody have any ideas and all this stuff? And I started pitching this idea of these mutants, but here's the thing, they're cybernetically enhanced, and I want to call it Cyberforce. And Rob would tell me later that, because he was at the meeting, he's going, don't say anything. Save this for Image Comics. We're going to talk to you. Save it for Image. Oh, it's a great idea. Save it for Image. Which, Marvel didn't bite, so.
They flat out said no.
Yeah, it's like, Cyberforce wound up as my first Image book. But after that meeting, ironically, we were there on Marvel's dime, but Image was forming.
The same New York City weekend, right?
It's the same weekend, because that's also when they approached Jim Lee, and Jim Lee was known as the Golden Boy. And Todd's thing has always been, look, if we can get Jim Lee, yeah, we got him. We win. If we can get Jim Lee on board, we win. But I was also part of that formula. Because I was on an X book, so I kind of mattered.
Yeah, you absolutely mattered, because you had been a top X-Men artist for a while. Interesting, because to a lot of people, they would think that what you guys did would be a tremendous risk, because you guys could fall flat on your faces.
Well, the sexy story is it was all risk, right? It's like, these guys went off, they did their own thing. It's like, the reality is, even looking back in 2020, we could have gone back. The biggest risk was embarrassment. And the lack of opportunity. That was really the biggest risk. Because the rewards were huge if it worked. If Image worked, the rewards were you own your IP, you own your idea, you can do whatever you want. And this was, you gotta remember, this 25 years ago. So things were just starting to look like other media exists. It wasn't like it is today where it's just part of it. Where you know that other media is looking at what you do. Every month, the studios and the networks have people that look at comic books every month to come with to them. It's like, oh, this one's cool. Back then, that wasn't the case, but there was rumblings that that could happen. Batman had come back with Tim Burton. So it's like, oh, maybe there's something there. Maybe there's not. We don't know. But point was, if it worked, which obviously it did, we were in control of our own destiny.
Cyberforce number one came out on October 9th, 1992. It was the same week as Youngblood number three and the same month as the second issues of Savage Dragon, Shadowhawk, Brigade, and Wildcats, as well as Spawn number five. The overall story arc was called The Ten Men of War. The first issue was respectfully dedicated to Jack Kirby. None of the other issues featured dedications. Written and drawn by Mark and Eric Silvestri. Letters were by Mike Heisler and colors were by Joe Chiodo. And I would say on the production level alone, it was a good-looking book. Joe Chiodo is a painter. I thought Mike Heisler was a solid letterer. Issue 3 had several inkers added to the mix, Dan Panosian and Trevor Scott, while issue 4 was inked by Scott Williams. And the book starts with Jacob Marlowe in the alley from Wildcats number 1.
When I first saw it, I thought immediately of Blade Runner, the character played by Daryl Hannah.
She's got the pale skin, the eye makeup.
Yeah.
I remember. Did Pris have red hair? I thought she had blonde hair, didn't she?
No, I thought she had red hair. I thought she had like...
Maybe it was a strawberry thing. I don't remember right now.
I just remember seeing that and I remember thinking Blade Runner. And then someone had talked to me, I want to say it was maybe my uncle. He kept saying, the book's going to be like Blade Runner. They're all half robots and androids. So I was thinking Blade Runner was like, in my mind, a really good sci-fi movie.
Well, it was still a cultural touchstone. People didn't know about things like cyberpunk, like the general public didn't. So if you're trying to come across with that vibe, Blade Runner was the easiest shorthand to reference in, 91, 92. Because you had like a big explosion of that type of material later in the decade. Hell, Keanu Reeves' career was about doing cyberpunk stuff for most of the 90s. But when Cyberforce was coming out, it was still kind of new to general audiences, I would say.
So basically, we're introduced to Cyberforce, the team. Velocity is running through the alleyways, being chased by someone.
Shock troops, right?
I believe so, yeah.
They're literally like S-H-O-C. It's an acronym for something, right?
Velocity, she's running away from the shock group.
And young girl. A young red girl. Hair, yeah. Slender. Trench coat, right? Everybody has a trench coat, don't
Pretty
they?
Pretty much, yeah. Well, I mean, she's a robot. So, yeah, she's running a trench.
Is she a robot?
Hair,
she's a cyborg, right?
She's a cyborg, yeah. But she has like a lightning bolt across her eye. And, I mean, the art's great. Sylvester's
was always great artwork style. As she's running, we're introduced to Ripclaw, who I believe was Native American.
Yes.
And he's their version of a Wolverine slash Warblade slash Sabretooth slash, you get the gist. It's right. Basically a Wolverine ripoff.
Well, and don't forget, he's also a poet.
Is he?
Yes, he writes junior high poetry that he wants to read to us over the course of our superhero adventure.
Oh, I thought Warblade. Warblade's the artist.
Yeah, he was artist.
He's the artist.
Ripclaw's the poet.
I forgot. They're all very,
and he's like Robert Bearclaw.
With their creativeness. Yeah. Because all they are rip-roaring kind of guys.
Well,
we're introduced to Ripclaw. Then we're introduced to...
Don't forget that the chick that's leading this shock is Ballistic. A blonde chick with guns. And doesn't she have like a cybernetic eye and shit?
I think so, yeah. We're being introduced to Timmy and his creator, what, Kevin?
Some shit like that.
Yeah.
It's a little white boy that's extra cute. And it turns out that he's a robot that was made by this other white dude who used to look like Timmy, but grew up and decided to make a version of his younger self, sort of, kind of. Weird shit. I don't know where the fuck Ted Space was. Grown man, young man, 20-something, making a little boy robot for himself.
And then, of course, we're introduced to Stryker, who will eventually be the lead, which would make Stryker different.
From Cable?
Yeah.
Because he's totally Cable. He's Cable with a ponytail and an extra robotic arm.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which I remember as a kid when reading it, I was like, fucking awesome, dude. He has three arms. Like, that was like the lamest thing to get excited about. But at that point, I don't remember ever seeing like a Cable-esque character with three arms.
One thing I've never found exciting in any medium is extra appendages.
Really?
A tail can be cool. I'm cool with a tail or some other additional prehensile thing, but if you have a third arm or a fourth arm, you're just going to kind of get in your own way, I feel like.
That's truly the Stranger.
Yeah, there's that.
That's truly the Stranger. Wasn't there an Image character that had four arms? It was a female?
I think in Bloodstrike. I think she's literally called Forearm or something like that, yeah. Or Foreplay, you know, maybe, some shit like that.
I have to give it to Larson. He came up with a lot of bizarre fucking characters, but at least his characters were cool and different. Like, you made me read all that Savage Dragon stuff, and I'm just like, these are actually interesting villains. And then we're introduced to Cyberblade, which is their Psylocke, basically. I mean, come on, basically.
Well, it's weird.
Let's be honest. Cyberforce is the X-Men, but it's the X-Men slash Marauders mixed.
Well, we're still trying to get through the actual plot of the book, but
there's no plot here. There's no plot.
There's a degree of plot, but the thing is, you know where Cyberforce came from?
Well, hold on. And the last character we're introduced to is Impact, who's basically a Hulk made out of metal. Go ahead, Frank.
No, he's Colossus. He's Colossus with a Jerry curl. He's bulkier, but
if you were to mix Colossus, Hulk, and the Rhino.
Big silver guy with segmented metal armor. He's invulnerable and superhumanly strong.
And just a side note.
The only thing that makes him mean that he's not Colossus is he's got a much worse costume and he's got that fucking Jerry curl. I mean, you watch the same documentary I watch. You don't remember that, Jeff?
No, I don't remember that part.
Sylvester pitches his own X-Men book, Mutants, but they also have cybernetic enhancements. And Bob Harris was like, nah. And literally like a day or so later, they caught him in a hotel bar and was like,
oh, that's right. They were both going to the same hotel. Yeah. I remember that.
And so it's like, okay, well, I'm just going to take my pitch and make it an Image book instead. I wouldn't be at all surprised if Psyblade was originally going to be Psylocke and they were just going to borrow it from the other books. But it's funny to me because, okay, obviously Psylocke was co-created by Alan Davis. And Alan Davis was the one who drew the issues that brought Psylocke into the X-Men. But then later on, Sylvester was handling the character and they decided since she wasn't going to be a big fighter, they were going to give her armors to protect her since all of her powers were based in
mental
powers.
Yeah, she had the little butterfly thing. Yeah,
right, and she had the purple and pink armor.
Yeah.
And that was, I believe, a Sylvester design, right?
Then
after the whole thing with the Siege Perilous, Jim Lee came in and did his 3-issue arc where they reintroduced Psylocke as an Asian woman, basically turned her into Elektra, right?
Yeah, ninja
worked with the hand and everything else. So even though Sylvester was the one who worked for that other Psylocke, and so if he were to like take back his design, like steal it back from Marvel, they'd be like, okay, well, yeah, that's what you're doing. But he takes Jim Lee's redesign of Psylocke and moves it into his book instead, which I thought was lame, you know? But she is clearly Psylocke. And then you look at some of the other members, it's literally like the most generic RPG powers. You got the fast one, you got the one with the heat projection, the strong and vulnerable one. Yeah, the Wolverine knockoff.
Real quick.
The main difference being, though, that it's drawn by Mark Silvestri.
I think
we can all agree. I think all the Image artists looked up to Silvestri because I think he, on a technical level, he's the best of the artists. Like, I think he's probably one of the better storytellers, but definitely in terms of perspective, in terms of proportions, anatomy, that kind of thing, he's definitely one of, if not the best of the lot of them.
So real quick side note, when we were talking about Psylocke, I do remember the issue where Colossus is slammed into her and they mentioned the only thing that saved her was the armor on her body because she would have been killed because she had a giant metal man slammed against her.
Right.
And so when you brought that, I was like, I remember remember that issue. They made sure to point that out. This armor has a purpose. Because, I mean, I remember thinking, why would a psychic need armor? Like, that makes no sense to me, except to protect them from long-range weapons. But anyway.
Well, and also, clearly, Cyberforce is all of Silvestri's predilections in one book. Because, let's face it, when he took over X-Men, what did he do? He made them all look like they were in a hair metal band. You know, they all had giant hair and armor and shit. And they all fought characters from Road Warrior. It was always about the Reavers or the Marauders.
What was the difference between the Reavers and the Marauders?
The Marauders was the group of mutants that were put together by Mr. Sinister to kill the Morlocks. But a bunch of them had metal armor.
Is that the guy with the tire tread? Tank tread?
No. See, he's Marauders Reaver, right? Was Scalp Hunter, who was basically a long-haired dude with like a handlebar mustache. And then Harpoon was basically an all-black with some metal highlights. Arclight was basically in silver armor.
There's some guy that spun that with the like stuff. Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, you're right. Sure. That's Marauders.
You had the big bruiser guy, I think Blockbuster or something was his name. And then with the Reavers, they were not mutants. They were cyborgs. Then they spin off from the group of guys that were in the Hellfire Club.
I believe
they
the Hellfire Club, I believe, used them almost like pawns. Used them to take care of
what it was is that the members of the Hellfire Club that went up against Wolverine in the Dark Phoenix saga. Mm-hmm. At some point, Jim Shooter decided that if Wolverine had actually killed all those guys, that he was a mass murderer and he'd be put on trial. So the only way that Chris Claremont could dissuade Jim Shooter from forcing him down into that story arc was to say, no, none of them died. He didn't kill anybody. He just mauled them. Right. So basically what they decided is that, okay, well, what we're going to do is all those guys are now cyborgs and they're coming after Wolverine for revenge for chopping off parts of them. And so if I remember correctly, the first cyborgs that showed up in that Barry Windsor Smith issue from like 206 of Uncanny X-Men, then they like hooked up with those Australian dudes and they formed like a full-on team of nothing but cyborgs who fought the X-Men in their Australian outback days when they were pretending to be dead.
Which were cool.
I thought that the Reavers were cool. I thought the Marauders were cool. I just...
If they showed up in Logan, dude, if that guy had showed up with tank treads in Logan, I would have nutted in the theater, dude. I would have just like, ugh! I mean, just skeet, skeet, skeet all over the place. Because they were the Reavers, and they just needed that one fucking dude with the tank tread.
Yeah. It was the thing with Silvestri. He always had these villains who had big guns and were cyborgs, because when he took over Wolverine, it became full of that same kind of thing.
He had LCD and the robot Wolverine. Yeah,
Wolverine
with the little girl. Yeah, that's right. But he does like drawing a lot of metal.
Yeah, and also a lot of that paramilitary shit. All those guys grew up on G.I. Joe, it seemed like, or they grew up on the 80s action movies. Yeah. So they always had to have a bunch of dudes with armor and big guns. And of course, that was all over Wolverine when Silvestri was doing it too. All the people from the Weapon X Project, Maverick and Wraith and Silver Fox, wasn't it? And all those other kind of people.
Oh, yeah, you're right. The Weapon X Squad or whatever.
Clearly, as we're going through these issues of Cyberforce, it's like, this is really an X-Men book in all but actual fact. It feels very much of a piece with all of his X-Men work.
We're introduced to Cyber Data, which is in their version of an evil computer Apple organization.
Is there Skynet?
There's Skynet. They were actually mentioned in Savage Dragon at one point.
They were kind of a big deal in there, right?
I always felt like those organizations were a way to keep all the books linked.
I really enjoyed that. I missed that about Image, is when they used to have that commonality.
Yeah.
But yeah, it wasn't like Overmaster like farmed out some of the mercenary
Cyber Data
stuff.
And they failed.
Never going to deal with those incompetents again.
Actually, Cyber Data rebuilt Super Patriot. Yeah. They were supposed to control Super Patriot to commit these murders, but make it look like a botched rescue.
But wasn't the Covenant of the Sword tied into Super Patriot as well?
I have no idea. Okay. Like we're
getting far into the
rings.
Going
deep cuts
now. Let's get back to Cyberforce.
Okay. And so we're introduced to the whole Cyberforce team.
Well, who else in this? The one we didn't talk about was Heatwave. And Heatwave is kind of the generic Cyclopsy kind of dude. He's got the same gear that we had with Cyclops, where he's got the headpiece, the open mask so that his brown hair can come out, and he's got that Blade Runner style where he's got the big collar and everything's poofy, big shoulder pads. Very 90s dude.
Are you sure we didn't record on this, man? I feel like we've recorded on this.
No, part of it is we went off on a tangent during Wildcats recordings.
Okay, because I'm looking at this.
But I don't want to discuss.
I'm looking at this issue and I'm like, I remember talking about this because it turns out Velocity and the chick that's chasing her down are sisters.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking like, wow, like these guys really, just by looking at this, they relied heavily on their art style, not so much on their writing.
Well, it's definitely a quinky dink that Ballistic and Impulse are going to be sisters. They do build that up over the course of the miniseries, though, where they both were they were abused as children.
Yeah.
And so they have this, but Ballistic was like her protector. But one of the big things they make a point of of in this book is that the people who work for CyberData have implants, chips implanted in their brains that make them more violent and make them more prone to following CyberData's directions.
Yeah.
And Ballistic has that chip, which is why she doesn't remember her sister and is willing to hunt her down, where Impulse does not have that chip, so she's...
Impulse.
No, sorry, Velocity. Sorry. It's fucking 90s, man, you know? Everything's a fucking adjective or a verb or a noun, you know? It's like they don't have...
I'm like, wait, are we talking about DC Comics? Like, wait, where's he going with this?
Velocity, sorry.
Okay, well, no. Well, that's not even the worst part, because Velocity and Ballistic are not only sisters, but the main villain, Mother, is their mother.
Mother May I. Who, I gotta admit, looks fucking cool.
Fantastic. Yeah, I love that blue and purple and yellow.
Well, she's basically Mystique, but like crossed over with Storm. She's got this very ornamental kind of style, a little bit African, a little bit Asian, but she's got that deep blue skin with a dark red hair like Mystique.
You know, you're right. You're right. I didn't think about putting
She looks freaking boss. She's really awesome looking. Mother May I, I'm not sure is that great of a name, but I think he's maybe trying to go for like a cool Alan Moore kind of thing with it. She's the leader of CyberData, and her big thing is she's also a mutant, right?
Yeah.
And so CyberData, like mutants are feared and hated in the Image, in this section of the Image universe, just like they are at Marvel. Because again, this is an X-Men book and all, but fact. And so Mother May I, just like Mystique, is like a revolutionary who's funding terrorist organizations of mutants and cyborgs and mutant cyborgs to help to protect mutant kind from the racism greater society. But because she's running CyberData secretly, she's having to funnel all these terrorist organizations through CyberData. So people don't know that she's actually controlling a lot of these terrorist groups that people are worried about.
And I just want to throw this in there. They do introduce some other characters. They introduce a character named Killjoy, which I think looks fantastic.
Yeah, such a great design. Describe Killjoy.
Killjoy, she has a Day of the Dead type skull in gold on her face with a long black ponytail. She's all robot. Dude, she's just a fucking badass.
What color was her costume?
It's purple.
Yeah, she's got like a uniform kind of red.
He's really into these purples and yellows. I'm noticing a lot of the female characters are, because Ballistic's in purple and yellow. Velocity's in purple. Killjoy's in purple. Mother May is in purple and yellow. They're definitely all in that purplish color.
He has
and
his then the spectrum. Villains,
the men are either red and white, red and silver, red and green. Yeah, there's a lot of dudes in red. So, I mean, Ripclaw is red and gray.
Was Heatwave red or tan? What color was Heatwave's suit?
Gray and yellow. Dude, Silvestri, his character design is on point. I'm looking at this. I mean, you got Ripclaw fighting some giant robot dude with, and again, three arms. This time, three appendages, a saw, some other kind of weird
saw.
He's
like Buzz Saw or Buzz Cut or some shit like that. After a while, it's hard to remember which ones
it's
were.
It's probably Buzz Lightyear or some shit like that. They're not very imaginative when it comes to that.
Particularly with Sylvester stuff, I tend to think of the Marvel UK Death's Head variations, like Die Cut and Death Metal, and it all kind of starts to run together after a while.
Actually, the dude with two arms, I think he has three arms on one side, dude.
But I think that dude's Buzz Cut.
He has three arms on one side.
It's the evil supervillain team that works with CyberData. But I don't remember the names right now.
I just know Killjoy. I remember thinking that was...
Are you still in the first issue?
No, I'm second issue.
Okay.
Oh, no, just trust me. If you're going to listen to this podcast, especially this one, I would recommend picking up the books and just following along with us.
Yeah, we're doing a commentary.
Yeah, we're doing a commentary on this one because I'm saving you a lot of pain because I read these books. And Frank read these books. Frank, how did you feel when you read these books?
Look, here's the thing. There's another podcast I listen to called 90s Comics Retrial. And two books that Nathaniel Wayne's been particularly kind towards were Cyberforce and Pit. And I think part of that was because he thought that both those books had a sort of sense of humor about themselves, and they had enough of a self-awareness, tongue-in-cheek approach to the type of stories they were telling.
Bullshit.
And I agree. No, I agree. There is an element of that, but there's attempted satire, and then there's actually effective, amusing, or insightful satire. This is just cheeky. It's still bad. It's still very imaged, very Chrome Image. I think it gives you a little bit of respite from that by being cheeky, but that doesn't mean the writing is actually good, and there's so much awful coincidence and basically a complete absence of plot. It reminds me a lot of the work that Mark Silvestri was doing with Larry Hama and Wolverine, where you just had these episodes that were existed solely to set up Wolverine getting into fights with people, but they didn't actually have proper plots. They didn't have any proper resolutions. It's just like a fight would happen because of a variety of circumstances. The fight would continue across a bunch of different scenarios, and then the fight would resolve without anything actually having been done. Just fight. Yeah. And Cyberforce is pretty much the same way, but with less thought put into it than Larry Hama's Wolverine.
Okay, so I'm going to go the opposite. I'm going to think you guys read too much into it to kind of compensate.
I do think that they gave it too much credit.
I don't believe there's this whole, well, see, there's this undertone. Nah. This dude was, look at my art. My art's going to fucking make you jizz. Don't read it because it doesn't make a lot of sense. Like, I just needed words on a page. I just need names, and I need to tell you some stuff, my art will explain. Because the artwork, if you look at it, I was looking, I'm not even looking at dialogue. I pretty much,
you can tell the story. He's a good storyteller. He's a great storyteller.
It's fucking phenomenal. When I read these, I remember sitting there going, Jesus, like, who wrote this?
I don't want,
like,
yeah, you don't want to read the dialogue
did
very much.
Someone, like, did you pay someone for this?
No,
like, can you get money back?
That was
for
literally
this?
Part of the problem with all the Image guys is he got his brother to help him write it. His brother, I think, was doing the scripts. And it's,
oh,
like,
my, so what did his brother do before? Was he like a manager at a Denny's or some shit? And he's like, I've heard these conversations at a table and it seemed interesting in a comic book world. This dialogue, I've known Frank 20 years. I really believe this is where you helped me evolve my enjoyment of this thing we do. I used to be all about the art and I would only buy books for the art. I would read them, but I didn't care as much about reading as much as the artwork. Then you were like, you turned me on to Peter David first. Because I remember I was reading all Peter and I just assumed, well, shit, all comic books. I mean, even as a kid, I remember reading Claremont. I just assumed all of them were this good. All books are this good. And then someone would give me like these really shitty books. I'm like, well, why isn't this as good as like the X-Men? And I started, well, let's look at the writer. Who's the writer of this book? And that's when I was like, okay, well, there's certain writers that you know their style. If you put them at the right character, you're going to get a really good story. That part of your life is going to be fulfilled with enjoyment of reading a great story. At this time, dude, these are just bad, dude. Like, if I own these, I'll give them away because I wouldn't want these in my collection. I love the artwork, but the writing is just so bad.
Yeah. The intention with Image, in part, was to show that you didn't need the companies and you didn't need writers. And they have
really,
proved
the writers, though, they really wanted to prove that you didn't need writers.
I think that, they wanted to show that they were the ones who were coming. Because here's the problem. A lot of the guys who formed Image were working on the X-Books, right? And one of the things that Chris Claremont, one of the reasons why he survived as long as he did is because he really turned over a lot of the plotting over to the artists. He let the artists kind of draw the kind of stories they wanted to draw, which is why the book would change so radically from artist to artist. When a new artist came on, the stories that were being told with those characters changed radically because he gave the artists a lot of latitude in the plotting. But then he would go in and he had this gift for telling the story with whatever the art was given to him. He was kind of like a Stan Lee where the artists were at least co-plotters, if not more so. It was actually one of the reasons why him and John Byrne bust up is Byrne basically decided, no, I wrote this book. I want the credit for the writing. And Claremont wouldn't allow for that. He was willing to let his artists do a lot of the plotting, but he ultimately still felt that he was the writer.
I mean, he did the dialogue, I'm sure.
Yeah, he did the dialogue and he guided the book and they would discuss what they were going to do, but he'd let the artists do a lot of the heavy lifting on the representation of what that story would be from issue to issue. And so a lot of these guys thought that they were writers because they had Chris Claremont to come in and kind of make it work what they were putting on the page. And with a guy like Silvestri, as you can tell, he's a great visual storyteller. But once you came down to doing the dialogue and figuring out who the characters were and conveying that to the audience.
Creating a voice for a character.
Yeah, they were bad at it. They were really, really bad at it. And so what Image ultimately proved was, no, you don't need to have a big company behind you to do well in the industry, to launch characters. But if you don't have writers, people are going to be making fun of you 30 fucking years later, you know? Yeah. These guys are still getting shit on for those books. And I think a lot of it is just because assholes went off and read more Marvel DC books, continue to support corporate comics, and they don't bother to expand their horizons. They haven't bothered to go and look and see what else is out there because they've got their heads so far up Marvel and DC's asses. But the fact is, yeah, a lot of these books were pretty bad, and they had an opportunity to really pull away readers permanently, and because of their hubris, because they didn't think that they maybe needed to get some writers into the mix, I think they kind of fucked themselves over. Then they fucked over the industry to some degree. I think that if the Image books had been better, they would have held on to more readers, and you wouldn't have had as bad of a speculator bust, you know? I think that Marvel is the worst about that. Marvel was the ones who did the most strip mining and put out the most junk bonds. At least the Image books had some value when they came out. Some of them had a fair amount of value to them. There were tons of Marvel product that never anything.
I think people who bought Image books bought into Image was, like me, we wanted that number one issue.
Well, no, but you were also excited about it. You were excited about all these new characters. You were excited about this gorgeous artwork, and the coloring is so much better than it ever been. The lettering became better than it ever been.
Did you read in before you were like, oh, this writing's horrible, though? Did you realize, I can't continue supporting this because it's just a bad product?
It was on a book-by-book basis, and it was over the course of a year or so, in part because the books were coming out so slowly. You know, if the books had been coming out on a monthly basis so I could have gotten a sense of them earlier on and not had months of pre-orders that were slowly coming in, I might have jumped ship faster. Mm-hmm. But because there's a book here, a book there, you know, maybe a couple or three books a month for most of the first year, then you could carry some of those books a little bit longer. But I jumped ship on some of the guys faster than other ones. By the time Cyberforce came out, I think it was something like the sixth or seventh title that Image released. And by that point, I was already pretty jaded. And so I bought Cyberforce number one, I think maybe to whichever. I stopped at whatever issue had the Image Zero coupon. Mm-hmm. Like, it was the number of the books. It's like, okay, I'm only going to buy it until I get my coupon, so I get my zero issue, and then I'm out. And yeah, I definitely was out before the end of the miniseries. I definitely never bought number four. Whatever the issue with the coupon was, that's where I jumped off of Cyberforce.
And so to me, that's my point, is people buy into DC and Marvel because they have all the cool toys, and you want to see what they're doing with
it. Well, they've got the history.
They got the cool toys.
They've had the cartoons and the movies that kind
of
hook you.
Image had photocopies of the cool toys. They had the knockoffs, but they were still cool toys, but they weren't smart enough to bring in people to give good stories.
They were smart enough to make sure everything else was great. They had the best production design. They had the best paper, the best coloring, great lettering. Everything was perfect except for the fucking writing, because they wanted to do their own writing and they didn't think they needed writers. And they were wrong.
They thought their brother
could
write. And
it really blew up in their fucking face. And the guys who realized the mistake the earliest tended to do the best. McFarlane, Jim Leaf, but too many of these guys kept giving work to their grade school buddies and their relatives and shit like that.
So how do you explain Eric Larson?
Eric Larson was a better writer than the rest of them.
Really?
He's been writing books for decades now. Yeah. He was writing the books even before then. He's basically been writing comics his entire life. He wrote all the stories that he was drawing when he was a little kid, when he got into independent comics. So he's much more on the Jim Valentino spectrum. He wrote, he drew. Back in the old days, I think he even lettered and colored his shit.
Oh,
you know,
wow.
He did everything just like Valentino. So one of the best ways to learn is by doing. He was doing all the work early on. McFarlane didn't fucking self-publish his own books. He didn't write anything before he started doing Spider-Man. He might have helped with the plotting, but he didn't actually write anything. Jim Lee co-plotted X-Men. He didn't write the dialogue for any of that shit. So there are a lot of these guys that had maybe done elements of writing, but for much less of their careers. But a guy like Larson is going to be better because he's been doing it his entire life. He learned how to draw from drawing comics for his entire life, and he got really good at that. And he was going to be better than the rest of the guys as a writer because he'd written. Yeah. The best way to become good at something is just do it over and over again, and you'll slowly learn over time what works and what doesn't.
So now to issue three, part two of our tension. So at the very end of the last one, Velocity is kidnapped by a group of villains in a van.
Oh yeah, that was terrible.
So,
okay,
again,
no, we know we have to take a minute for this. Okay, right?
Dude, but that makes no sense.
We've already set up.
Whatsoever.
Okay, hold on. But no, we need to explain this, right? So Cyberforce, the good guys, are the mutants that are collecting these loose renegade cyborg mutant hybrids that get loose from cyber data. They exist in the shadows.
Okay. Think of them as Morpheus, and they're going in there and they're releasing these cyber data characters.
Yeah. Catching
Neos as they're falling from the sky, trying to rehabilitate them and
rehabilitate the images of the mutants and the cyborgs, and also fight the evil machinations of cyber data. Right.
Okay.
So cyber data is the terrorist organization that's also a corporation. So they're the bad guys though, and they have their shock troops and they have their ship zombie, whatever you want to call them. But then there was another group of people. Okay, and Velocity gets brought in by Cyberforce to protect her against cyber data. So then you have this other group of people that are mercenaries that, if I remember correctly, were hired by cyber data to steal a piece of equipment or a piece of data from another corporation that's the rival of cyber data. And so they're escaping with these materials, and they just happen to run into Velocity, and they end up kidnapping her and Timmy specifically because their van gets wrecked, their vehicle gets wrecked, and so they're stealing her vehicle. So it's just completely coincidence that she runs into this stuff. But it's the kind of coincidence that is completely unbelievable. There's no way that all these random things would happen all at the same time. They're just going to happen to kidnap Velocity. And then because Cyberdata wants the information that the mercenaries have, they go after the mercenaries, I guess because they don't want to pay them or something. I don't remember what the specific details were. And then they happen upon Velocity, this person they're also tracking down. It's like, come on, that's just way too many fucking coincidences. But as an added thing, the mercenaries, there's like a bi-beast. There's like a guy, he's like two people who are like two heads who speaks in like a German accent. One of them speaks in a German accent, and one of them, I think, is like an English accent. And so they're kind of have this weird banter between
the two
heads.
His name is like
heads.
Iron Cross or some shit. Hold on.
I think, doesn't he have like a swastika or something too?
I'll check.
One of the things that I think Nathaniel Wayne specifically said that he liked, because he thought it was humorous to have this weird goofball character in the mix, very Larson-esque type character to have in the book. But for me, it was just kind of grating because it wasn't funny. It was just sort of a forced attempt at humor, but it didn't cover up how stinky the plot was. So, while I'm thinking about it, the Asian newscaster from Spawn Comics also had a cameo in the book.
Yes, very nicely done, Frank. All that from memory? That was their thing where they were kind of mixing elements of their book so that you felt a connection in this whole world.
Yeah, it was a universe back then.
Yeah. Let's see. What's his name? There's a dude with six arms, whatever. There's the van. Me brother. And I always like to start the day with a big bang. Nice work. Split screed?
Yeah, I think it's split screed. Yeah. Bad pun. Yeah.
one of the other characters' name is Slams.
Yeah, was that the thing, like the big blocky thing?
Yeah, it's just like a thing. Yeah, his name is Slams.
Just a generic bruiser.
Splits Creed, Slam, some chick. Basically, yeah, they kidnap Velocity and Timmy. No real part because of some chips, some microchips they stole. Splits Creed, actually, one of his faces does have a swastika on it. It's a tattoo of swastika. Very well done, Frank. All this from memory? You know it's never going to leave your mind now, right? It's trapped there forever. And then, of course, as they're trying to make their escape, they are attacked by some dude who shoots flames out of his hands, and he blows up the van, and then it stops there and says, next, entering Pit. In issue 3, we're introduced to Pit. Frank, would you like to tell us?
Well, reintroduced, because Pit's already been in the comics.
Has he been out already for a while?
Because he'd had, the first issue of Pit ended up coming out before the supposed preview for Pit. It was Youngblood number 3, but Youngblood number 3 was so late that the 4-page, 6-page backup-ish story of Pit came out like a week after Pit number 1, which the problem image had repeatedly. But we already knew who Pit was by the point time Cyberforce number 3 came out, because it was also really fucking late. Between 1 and 2, there's a 4-month gap. Between 2 and 3, there's a 4-month gap. And it's only 3 and 4 that were actually a month apart.
So, of course, this group decides to battle. Okay, so the initial group that's against Cyber Data sent that rogue group to steal something that then it gets attacked by Killjoy and that group. It's so fucking easy. So, Killjoy and her hit squad.
It pays not to think about it. It's an excuse for a bunch of people to fight.
Yeah, punch, punch, fight, fight. Everyone's running around, battling. I still think Killjoy looks great, though.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. Again, Silvestri didn't get what he was doing. Everybody that I've heard from who talk about Cyberforce in the modern day points to Killjoy and how cool she looks. So the characters he focused on were everybody but Killjoy.
Yeah.
Literally, like, Ballista got her own miniseries. I think Psyblade got at least a one-shot, if not a miniseries. Stryker got an ongoing series spinoff. But Killjoy, who was a villain, I don't know if she's ever had a book of her own. And that's the one that everybody's like, wow, she looks really cool. Who's that? But I did notice that in the most recent revamp of Cyberforce that's coming out soon.
Who's writing it?
I don't recall. I don't think it's a known quantity who's writing it. The second issue prominently features Killjoy, so I think there's something to that.
Now, does DC own Cyberforce?
No.
They just own all of Jim Lee's
Just
toys,
Wildstorm.
Right?
Just Wildstorm.
Okay.
Silvestri got his start at Image as part of Homage Studios. His books were all coming out of that little subdivision of Image, but he very quickly spun off into his own studio, Top Cow, and he holds all the copyrights to his characters. But there are some interesting bleeds here and there, though. Like, for instance, I asked Liefeld this in a tweet that he never replied to, but DC owns Hellspont. Hellspont is an alien Daemonite who possessed an Aurelian, which is a alien race that Liefeld owns. It's from Youngblood Comics. So how do the rights work on that? Again, you mentioned Super Patriot. You know, Larson clearly owns Super Patriot, even though he's apparently derived from Cyber Data, right? His origins are from that. So there is some weird little bleed there, but most everything that you know from Silvestri's wing of Image is entirely owned by him.
So does Top Cow still produce comics?
Yeah.
I really haven't seen anything from Top Cow.
They contracted, I noticed, in recent years. They were going pretty strong for a long time, but recently the like Top Cow universe has kind of fallen apart.
They finally
ended Witchblade.
The Darkness.
They haven't done Old Darkness book recently, to my recollection. They're relaunching Cyberforce, but like all the Artifacts books, there's a whole line of books about the Artifacts, like the Witchblade and the Darkness. Yeah. Those are all gone now. That's all been canceled. They recently relaunched Witchblade again because they briefly had a series called Switch that Stefan Sedgwick was doing, where it was like a new Witchblade and a new relaunch, but they left and now they're doing an actual Witchblade book again. So it's sort of like they're kind of rebuilding Top Cow. Top Cow managed to sustain a universe for a long time, longer than most Image founders, frankly.
Except Larson.
Well, Larson doesn't really have a franchise anymore. He has Savage Dragon. There really isn't anything else surrounding Savage Dragon anymore. It's just the one book, where Top Cow was actually a line of books.
You're right. Because he had multiple. Because I was going to say, what about McFarlane? But no, McFarlane only has Spawn.
He's pretty much just Spawn nowadays. Yeah.
Yeah.
So they've all contracted significantly. All the pretty ponies at Image now are the standalone projects by guys like Brian Vaughn. The actual Image founders, for the most part, have kind of been forgotten to some degree. They've kind of been pushed to the background some. Like, very recently, Eric Stevenson was promoted to a partner at Image. He now co-owns Image, and as well as being their publisher, in part because he's so successfully transitioned Image to becoming the Vertigo or the Icon or whatever you want to call it. It's the home of creator-owned books. There are a lot of publishers out there I'm worried about now because so much of what they used to do is being done by Image. They don't have anything to support them like they used to have. Dark Horse in particular I'm worried about because they've lost a lot of their shit. Yeah.
Star Wars.
Yeah, exactly.
All they have now is Alien, Predator, Terminator.
We'll talk about that in a few. Stevenson has really made Image a force in comics again, but that doesn't really impact on the Image creators in terms of their market share for their little branches and stuff. If McFarlane selling books are only selling 20,000 copies or less, he's not really that relevant to modern comics. Larson's books only sell so well, and obviously the Top Cow is no longer a line of books. There's like a smattering of books. They've just recently launched Cyberforce again, which is like the second or third relaunch within the last decade. They just relaunched Witchblade for the second time in 5 years. I think they're struggling now. They did sustain for a fairly long period of time, so you got to give Top Cow credit for that.
Okay.
They also got some writers, so that helps.
I picked up from the library the new Warren Ellis is writing it, Wildstorm. Is that for DC though, right?
It's DC, yeah.
Oh, never mind. Thought it was Image. My bad.
I would have checked it out if it was still a creator-owned company, but it's a more DC product. I'm not interested in supporting DC product. Even though I have an affection for those characters, I'm not interested in seeing Warren Ellis do his typical cynical, bitter revamps of characters that I had an affection for. It'd probably just piss me off anyway, so.
I'm sure Martian Manhunter will come out cool in this one.
Okay, yeah, Warren Ellis.
He was part of them for a while.
Yeah, I guess that's, I liked that, but they didn't do anything with it, so.
Mother May I don't know, dude, like where to go with this? I mean.
Well, I do remember that I think it was the CIA or the FBI, some government agency went to Stryker randomly while he was, I love this, he was pumping iron, like lifting weights with his cybernetic arm, which is like, why would you be building the muscles in your cybernetic arm? It's anyway, so they recruit him to infiltrate CyberData to get close to Mother May I to find out her plans and potentially take her out. And so he becomes a highly placed member of CyberData in the span of like between issues 2 and 3, basically. They set up a circumstance where he saves Mother May I's life. And I think he even becomes her lover, right? The Asian dude who actually runs CyberData, who's like the corporate chair that's in the building running the company, who's also in love with Mother May I, gets like super pissed off about that and starts to turn on Mother May I as a result of that, of her relationship with Stryker that again occurred between issues like 2 and 3 of a 4-issue miniseries.
The one character I gotta admit that looked pretty cool was the Buck on the Mother May I's group, the deer.
Oh yeah, he did look cool.
He looked pretty cool.
Adam Warren did a similar character for Empowered that was really badass. Adam Warren.
Oh really?
So I don't know if they were related, if he happened to be looking at that Image book, but yes, for some reason cybernetic steer men are really cool looking, but you don't see them very often. I think Chris a bitch to draw.
That group escapes from the shock troops and they get back to their base, and the female villain is telling what was the name of the Slams and Blitzkrieg or whatever his name is, the mercenary guys, that they got an ace up their sleeve, and they're like, who? And she goes, oh, this guy named Pitt who just happens to be sleeping on the couch.
Yeah, they just randomly, like, he's hanging out at their base. They just like they're like, what are they, like squatters or some shit?
I'm assuming so, yeah.
And so Pitt just randomly starts squatting, and so they're like, oh, okay, well, we take advantage of this, and because no coincidence is too far-fetched for a Cyberforce comic, apparently.
Well, I mean, at this point, Cyberforce decides to attack the mercenaries. The CyberData group killjoin them, kidnap Velocity and Timmy, but Cyberforce thinks that the mercenaries still have them, so they're going after them, not realizing they've been kidnapped by
a second set of kidnappers.
I just had a moment of Princess's Bride. This is inconceivable! So they attack the mercenary group, Impact and all of them come rushing in, and who's there to start kicking ass? The 80s heavy metal guy, Pitt. Pitt just starts kicking ass, who basically is just a Hulk ripoff with a mullet and claws.
And no nose.
This is where the fun starts. So Pitt is beating up Cyberforce. Then the shock groups with Killjoy decide they're going to attack. So then now you have three armies all battling at the same time. Impact gets his ass beat. Cyberblade gets her ass beat pretty bad. Pitt looks like he's just beating the shit out of anybody that's in front of him. Killjoy goes after Pitt. She's attacking Pitt, doing no damage. Then Slam walks up behind her and slaps, basically beats the shit out of her. And it's just a free-for-all. Sylvester just drawing three groups of characters beating the living shit out of each other. And we find out later that Velocity and Timmy are being held hostage by Mother May I. And they're trying to escape. It looks like Mother lets them escape because part of her deep, dark plan. Cyberforce then attacks Mother May I. Stryker in his four arms is actually battling.
So he has three arms.
Well, he has three arms on one side and a fourth. He actually has one arm and three arms on the other side.
Right. Oh, so he has four total. Okay, yeah. Math.
Yeah. Apparently Frank's nemesis. And so they're battling a lot of...
Wait, does he have three arms on one side? I thought it was two arms on one side and one on the other side.
One side. Cybernetic arms.
Jeez, that's really excessive.
I know, trust me. When we were talking about it in the beginning and I said three arms and then I relooked, I'm like, when he's lifting the barbells, there's one side that has three barbells and one in his, which, okay, why would you need to lift weights with a cybernetic arm?
So stupid.
It's not going to get bigger. It makes no sense. And before somebody on our fucking page puts on, it's for balance. Bullshit. The dude's fucking way overweight. He has three arms on one side. He technically should not be able to walk. He should be dragging one side of his body, if you think about it.
Oh, could you imagine what they would do to his back? You know, I mean,
those have to be like super thin ass metal.
That dude is not ergonomically correct.
No.
Like, his cybernetic enhancements are not ergonomically conscientious.
He defies physics in the most obnoxious way of like, oh yeah, I got three arms on one side and they're all made out of metal and they're all fucking super masculine. And guess what? I walk just fine. So Mother May I, they're battling. They're still battling. They're battling some more. A little bit more battling. Their dear dude there gets his ass whipped.
Yeah, this was another thing. You just reminded me of something that drove me nuts about these books. For some reason, and I vaguely remember this from his work on Marvel as well, the one technical aspect that Silvestri just completely mucks up in comics, his books just stop. Mm-hmm. Like, he never builds to any kind of a big climax to where it ends, you know, in like a cliffhanger, like a big thing. It always just stops running.
Well, no, he did.
Because, like, you know, the one is your...
He had an elevator with the group all in the elevator drop, and then it goes, done, to be continued.
The elevator's, like, dropping, or it's just, yeah, like, you know,
they're in an elevator dropping.
It's a weak ass ender. Didn't one of the issues end with a van blowing up or ramming?
Yeah, that's
into
the last one. That's, yeah, when Velocity and them are kidnapped, yes.
And it just stops. You know, and it doesn't have like a proper ending.
I think so.
Like, did they even have the shock troopers at the end of issue two, or was it just an impact happened on the van and then the shock guys show up in the third one?
I think the shock guys just show up.
Yeah, third, yeah. So it's like, that's not how you end a comic book. That's not how you stop a story in progress. I'm telling you,
again, for anyone listening to this podcast, at their office desk, they should have these issues in front of them, because we're skimming the art. We're not really talking about plot points.
Well, we both read the story.
This was not a spoiler-heavy episode. If anything, we are critiquing.
Well, the truth is, having read the story, I might have taken some notes the first time, but I didn't keep up with those notes. And I think I might have just plain stopped, because I'm like, I just sort of gave up, because there's not any kind of really detailed plotting going on here. And because in recent episodes of Spawnometer, I've just talked way too much about shit that didn't need to be talked about to that degree. I think being organic is probably the better way to approach this, because if we actually go at it detail by detail, we're just going to be bitching the whole time.
Oh, yeah.
We're just going to be shit talking, at least.
And no one's going to want to listen to us. Hell, I don't want to listen to us half the time. So anyway, issue four starts out with... Here we go. Apparently there were some riots that broke out with mutants who were stealing shit. Mother May I is upset. This is actual dialogue. Come on, Stryker. We've got better things to do than listen to some arrogant, self-serving son of a sewer rat talk about how deeply committed he is to protecting all this fair city from hordes of hideous mutants. Just, God, dude. I guess you could say a writer helps a character find their voice. And when you have a group of characters, each voice is distinctive enough that when you read it, it feels like you're listening to a group, not the same guy write dialogue for every character that sounds exactly the same, that you could interchange any character. So
one element of writing that doesn't get talked about enough is the quality of delusion that comes into play, because these characters live inside your brain to such a degree that they start to form their own personalities, their own inclinations, and so you just sort of like transcribe these scenarios that play out in your brain about what these characters would do and say and shit. And so that makes them natural. It gives them sort of a life of their own. Obviously, they still exist inside your head. So it's kind of a little bit nuts to even allow that to happen. It's like, you're a writer. Why aren't you dictating to the characters what they're going to do? But part of what allowing those characters to form their own personalities, and of course, you're drawing from people in your life and things like that. So they kind of, again, they take on a life of their own. Where when you're writing a character and you're not familiar with writing, you don't understand that you have to live with those characters 24/7. Writers are constantly thinking about their characters, constantly thinking about stories, constantly playing out variety of scenarios. Whenever you write a story, the bits and pieces you remember, it's almost like a dream where you're trying to remember the certain parts of the dream, and that's the parts you can actually get on the paper, but you never get everything onto the page because there's just too much floating around your head. But a lot of times with amateur writers, they're still figuring out how to just take the thoughts of their brain and put them on paper at the most basic level, how to tell a story at the most basic level, not the kind of higher functioning, crazy, required to actually have characters have souls and convey that onto the page. And so that's why you end up with this terrible dialogue and these nonsensical plots, because they're just, stuff is happening. Because you've decided stuff is going to happen and it's very inorganic.
Okay.
And you can't deal with a variety of vectors. So you create these bizarro scenarios that don't make sense or rife with coincidence because you're just trying to make something happen you decided needs to happen.
I'm assuming Stryker at this time is still under control of their Mother May I. They're separating Timmy and Velocity.
If I remember correctly, is somewhere, I think it was between issues 3 and 4, Velocity actually escaped from Cyberdata. And then like in the gutters at some point, she got recaptured and they just basically reset all that shit. Why did you bother having her escape in the first place? Yeah. It almost felt like they weren't reading their own comics from issue to issue to know what was going on.
I take it there was probably not a lot of plotting. They just...
Yeah, I think that they were just drawing shit sometimes, you know?
And so Mother May I is hyping up all the mutants. She's making out with Stryker. They keep doing the this thing where they put up dates like Wednesday, 8:31 p.m., computer control center.
I find that that's a tell for me. I automatically start to question whether or not I'm reading a good story when they do that shit, because that's one of those things you do when you feel like you need to put something on the page. It's like, I'm going to put a date and a time, and that'll set the scene. It's like, no, that doesn't set shit. You're just giving data that nobody's going to pay attention to, because unless that data becomes relevant,
it's just taking up space.
It's just taking up space. It's like, I put something on the page. I typed a date and a time. And when you do that over and over again, and it doesn't have any meaning, because it's like Chekhov's gun. If you're going to go through the trouble of putting those kind of exact details onto the page, they need to be relevant. It needs to mean something. It's like, oh, that's a timestamp. I need to know that specific date and time because of something else is going to happen later in a story and you don't know. You need to pull like some kind of fucking memento shit where all of a sudden all those dates and times like, oh yeah, they told us the whole time. This happened before this, so they're fucking with us, you know? Like, yeah. Or Tarantino kind of thing where you're fucking around with the chronology, and so it's important to have those kind of timestamps. But so many movies just randomly start putting timestamps because it's something to put on the screen, or it's a shortcut to tell you that you've shifted scenes. So when you do that, it lets me know that you couldn't do that in a way that was more artful. You had to just be as blatant and obvious as possible. Okay, this is where the scene's changing now. Oh, we're going to a different place with different people. That's not good writing. So I automatically start going, hey, wait a second, when that happens. And I'm automatically going to become more critical when that happens, because it's just such a bad cheat. Tell that you don't know what you're doing when you do that shit, especially when you do it a lot, and especially when it doesn't pay off in any way. You're just wasting the audience's time. Because imagine if you're reading that book, like let's say you're a fan of Lost, for instance, right? And so you're sitting there and you're trying to pull these clues together and make it all work out. And then in the series, it turns out it's all like a fucking dream and none of that shit matters.
Not even. They're in purgatory.
Yeah. So you're fucking pissed because you've devoted all this time and brain space to figuring out how all these pieces fit together for the writers ultimately to go, nah, it doesn't mean anything. It was all a bunch of bullshit. You resent the shit out of that.
Yeah.
And when you do it one time, people are always going to remember that you fucked them, and they're never going to forget. And they may forgive at some point, but they never forget that time you fucked them, that you made them think that they needed to put the effort into something and you were just bullshitting them the whole time. It pissed you off. And so, yeah, when books do that, it's like you're going through all these details. So either it's meaningless and you're just wasting your time and ours by putting that shit there, or you're actually fooling somebody into thinking that it is meaningful. And when it turns out that it doesn't mean anything, you're just going to piss them off. Unless you're actually doing something with it, don't do that shit. It's bad writing.
They do that several times here. At one point, Wednesday, 5:37 p.m., cyber data, technologies building, medical wing center. And this is Killjoy. You're very resilient, Velocity. The most difficult we've ever had. So this time, we'll make a clean sweep start from scratch. A whole new you. Well, not really you. Not you at all. That's actual dialogue. Now, granted, I don't give it any justice by reading it out loud, but that just gives you an idea of this is what you have to read to get through the book. Now, again, artwork, great. He looks like he's taking some shortcuts now because there's a lot of blocks. Like, he's not doing detailed work.
Yeah, I remember in the fourth issue, all of a sudden there's a lot of silhouettes.
Yeah,
and
there's
shit.
A lot of silhouettes, a lot of shadows. Yeah,
isn't most of the action at the very end of the book just a bunch of almost, silhouettes?
I mean, you have a whole panel of just like a hand covering a mouth. Mm-hmm. So it definitely feels like he was getting a little burnt. Look at it. I mean,
well,
huge
not just
close-ups.
That, yeah, the shit where you're taking 4 months in between issues and you're realizing, okay, I can't get away with the shit anymore. So you start taking shortcuts to just push it out.
So Shock and Cyberforce are battling again like they've done before. And yeah, you're right. At the very end, they have this huge battle. Everyone's battling. Kevin's there battling, trying to get Timmy back. Here comes Killjoy and her crew. Ballistic puts a gun to Velocity's head, telling everybody to stop, but she's going to blow her brains out. Ripclaw's ripping the big dude with three saws.
There was one part too. Wasn't it Ballistic that stabbed Velocity in the leg? And that's how they managed
to capture
her at one point.
She threw a blade, yeah, to stop her from running.
Yeah.
Because
this was issues ago, but
yeah,
I just remember
but Velocity's
that.
Thing is just run. Think of JLA version of Flash, where she's kind of like, I don't know how to do it. I just know how to run, because she really hasn't
well,
done
not, not the you mean like the cart, the movie,
the movie, yes,
the
I'm
Snyder
sorry, yeah, the movie.
Weed movie,
yeah. That, because she doesn't
run.
Really fight. All she does is run.
Well, again, that's one of the problems with the book is her entire personality is she runs away from stuff and she hangs out with Timmy and kind of is like a big sister to Timmy. That's her entire characterization in the four issues. And she's pretty much the lead character in the story.
Well, yeah. Well, she's the one that brings all the groups together because her sister's in one group. Cyberforce is trying to help her. She's Mother May Eye's daughter.
She's kidnapped by the mercenaries. Yeah.
Yeah, she's the focal point of this book. And, you know, they're battling and then I think Ballistic has a last minute. She starts kind of like, oh, this is my sister. And you have the guy that runs Cyber Data decide that he's going to betray Mother May Eye. He shoots her. Turns out that she has a psychic power that she can control you. She controls a dude, makes him put the gun to his head, blows his own brains out. Well, no, pulls the trigger, but there's no bullets. My bad. Dude, it's been a while since I read this.
Well, we're kind of just barreling through the conclusion. You can just kind skip some of the finer details and just get to the finale.
Okay, so at the very end, of course, this bomb goes off. It blows up next to Ballistic, which kind of knocks her senses loose. And she starts to remember that her and Velocity are sisters. Of course, we gave it away too soon, but that's the big reveal that Mother May I was their mom the whole time. Mm-hmm. When she starts remembering that. And so she's like,
wait. Kind of like how Mystique was Rogue's mom and later Nightcrawler's mom as well.
Was she Mystique's mom? I mean,
she was definitely Rogue's adoptive mom.
Okay, adoptive mom, but she wasn't her
blood
mom. But
then it turned out she was like Nightcrawler's mom, and she also was like didn't her and Sabretooth have a kid together as well? Oh. There was like an evil senator or some shit.
I don't know. I didn't stick with the X-Men that long. Velocity saves Ballistic. She catches her and she's like, just let me go. No, you're my sister. And she's going to hold on to her. But then Velocity as well is falling off, and then Stryker pops up and he grabs both of them, rescues them. They walk in. They find Mother May I. She basically says, you know, I guess you're my daughters or some bullshit like that. Take care of my girls. They end, and we are then introduced. Wait, is this a new group? The very end? I don't remember this page for some reason. We're introduced to Bloodbow. That's a character's name, Bloodbow. Bloodbow got more guts than common sense. Got to be the first of everything. Then we have Tempest.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Don't get to that. That's the codename Strike Force preview. We're not going to get that.
Oh, okay. My bad. Well, yeah, it's at the very end.
We'll do that.
Oh, okay. They really don't. Okay. See, the way they do it is they do it back to back.
Yeah. It just
so I just
stops.
Assume it was.
Well, once again, we discussed Mark Silvestri doesn't know how to end a book.
True.
So it just.
Oh, yeah. Then, so, that's, yes. That's an example of what you just said. Yeah.
So having read 10 Men of War, like, did you carry on with Cyber Force after that point, or did you drop it after the first miniseries? Yeah. So we both dropped it.
I never read the ongoing series, so I couldn't tell you what happened.
Yeah. And I just wasn't as committed to Cyber Force going into the Image books. Like, some of the books I gave a little bit more of a link to, stuck with for a while. Some of them I've revisited more. Cyber Force is one of those ones I'm not really looking forward to reading. I'm going to read them as part of Spawnometer, but we're not going to do as deep a dive into Cyber Force as we will some of the other titles. I mean, unless it turns out to be awesome. Maybe it becomes awesome when the ongoing series comes.
I honestly, at this point, I think I was kind of turned off by Image, and I was really interested in, I believe at the time, Valiant was getting big, wasn't it at the time?
Yeah. Valiant was around before Image. They were kind of growing parallel to one another.
Yeah, and I remember getting really into Solar and Exo Manowar.
Yeah.
Big time. That was a majority of my money that was going toward that, and you know, my usual Marvel titles and a couple of DC titles. But I backed off of Image at that point because, I mean, I was still reading Spawn, Savage Dragon, and Little Odds and Ends, but I wasn't, like, I remember Cyber Force, I wasn't really caught. Wildcats, I got kind of burnt out on. I just didn't see anything going with it. Shit, they had so many trolls. I mean, I just remember Image was always taking up that table of yours. Like, there was so much Image on there, and I just didn't know what to pick up.
Yeah.
Plus, at $1.95, man, it wasn't cheap.
Which is half the price right now.
No, I know. I mean, just to bitch about $1.95 today's laughable, but back then, I mean, $2 a book, and I was already...
Well, a lot of these books jumped up to $2.50 pretty quickly, too.
Yeah, and I was picking up a lot of books. I remember I was like... There was times I was like, fuck, this is way too much. I'm spending way too much money on this shit.
We've got at least one more deeper dive episode of Cyber Force, and then we'll kind of see where it goes from there. We got some Spawn action, I guess we could call it, from 108 Sage, All the Pouches and Image Comics Podcast, Backseat Directors, The Bat Boy, Pico Django, Carlos Digital, Charlton Hero, Chris at Bad Books for Beginners, Chris W. Brandon, Coffee and Comics, Derek William Crabb, Dr. Gene Nerdologist, Dorkness Delight, Ed Moore Jr. at Miskatonic and Teal Productions, Fanholes Podcast, Geekery with Dante D, The Hammer Strikes Random Geeky Stuff, History of Comics on Film, The Hoopers, Into the Weird, Jared Albrecht, The Yard Sale Artist, Jeffrey Brown, Jennifer Ross, Joe Crawford, John M. Wilson is podcasting again, Justin's First Dawn, Kaiser Leo, Kella Chuckawoo, KCW, Christados, Longbox Crusade, Lost in Time, Max Romero, Michelle Fife, Nethead, Odell Abner Dracula, Paul D. Nolan, Podcast Partners, Quentin Beck, Rad Adventures Podcasting Network, Represent Heads, Resurrections and Adam Warlock and Thanos Podcast, Richard Field, Secret Wars and Beyond Podcast, Sean Michael Ortega, Sean Phillips, Siskoid, Steve Sellers, Tim Price, and Varangian Vigilante. Kaiser Leo wrote, "That issue, referring to Spawn number 11, really lost me. It was a story that could have worked on another comic, but not in Spawn." Justice First Dawn wrote, "I'm dying to hear your take on early Superman with a Tude Supreme. While the Moore run is lauded, the first series did eventually find its footing. When Wetworks was finally released, released. I think I only read the first issue and dropped it. They did make four awesome action figures, though. Jeffrey Brown wrote, I like Wentworth's. I think mostly because of Will Portacio's artwork. I still like his work. It reminds me of the movie Predator with how the central team of Wentworth's looks. That comic to me was always a curiosity. Mother One had an interesting design and Grail 2. John M. Wilson wrote, on Supreme, I remember rather liking the first issue and the promise it held. The later issues didn't quite meet that, but I'm looking forward to revisiting the series and hearing your take. Finally, Odell Abner Dracula wrote, regarding human heads mounted as trophies, there's a memorable panel from Sin City and Dark Horse Presents featuring this concept. I think it predates the Supreme story, but I'm not 100% sure. And then later on adds, I gotta learn to listen to the whole podcast before commenting. Since you guys brought up Omaha and Birdland, part of my Omaha the Cat Dancer art by Reed Waller. The rest is pretty detailed. There's a picture of Omaha and another ostrich lady. Mm-hmm. He didn't show everything because, as he points out, when he got a Fritz drawing by Gilbert Hernandez, he specifically asked for all her clothes to be on after the Omaha deal because he got a more erotic picture than he intended to get.
Wow.
So a little too explicit to show off. We'll put up what he gave us on the blog if you want to check that out. I know you're a Hernandez Brothers fan too, so you'll probably want to check that out
Loving Rockets.
Image Comics, formed in 1992 by several creators unhappy with their current place in the industry. So they band together to make a new comics company for a new generation of readers. Creator-owned, mutants, cops, black ops government agents, demon-possessed, and they are going to be the greatest comics ever. In April of 1992, the first issues hit the stands, and fandom resounded with cries of...
Pouches? Why are there so many pouches?
What? You don't like pouches? All the Pouches, an Image Comics podcast, is one fan's exploration of those early years of Image Comics. Youngblood, The Savage Dragon, Spawn, and more, with maybe even a few pouches along the way. So come give a listen at johnreadscomics.com. That's John with no H. Just you can spell it right.
You're listening to Donuts and Top Cow.
Two great tastes that taste better together.
My name is John Grigas.
Mine is Josh Crawley.
We're back here sitting on the Comic Book Noise family feed and happy to be hanging out with you. Yes, we do have donuts, but we also have adult libations to go along with it.
Good journey.
Who likes comic books? Who likes superheroes? Who likes superhero comic books from the 90s? That's, yeah. That's about what I expected. Hey there. I'm Nathaniel Wayne from the Council of Geeks, and while I have always loved superheroes, the only period in which I was actually buying superhero comic books was during the much maligned 1990s. Now, those comic books were sitting in my mother's attic for about 15 years, appreciating in value not even a little bit. I've now recovered them, and I'm going to be going through these things issue by issue, story by story, and try and answer, in my own little way, the big question of, were 90s comics really that bad? Chances are that the answer is going to be yes, but I think that these comics deserve another shot, and they're going to get it on my new podcast, 90s Comics Retrial, part of the Council of Geeks podcast. You'll find it on iTunes under Council of Geeks, and you can also go to 90scomicsretrial.wordpress.com. So check it out and take this little trip down memory lane with me. A memory lane paved with what may be some of the worst comic books ever written. We'll find out.
This is a fan-produced, not-for-profit podcast. No copyright infringement is intended, and any use of copyrighted materials believed to be covered under fair use. If you don't agree, you can go straight to hell!